Welcome to How'd You Think of That? I'm Jalene Bailey. Imagine a table crowded with promising young STEM students, all eagerly chatting about their career paths in computer science, engineering, math, technology. But something is missing. There are not enough seats at the table for young women. Ruth Farmer has dedicated her life to changing that, even when it takes bringing in the folding chairs to make room. She's breaking the barriers that keep not only girls away, but also low-income students and people of color. On this episode of How'd You Think of That, Temple Grandin talks to Ruth Farmer, CEO and founder of the Last Mile Education Fund.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You and I sat next to each other on a flight in 2011 for about 4 hours, and you broke down the Fukushima disaster for me.
Yeah.
Farmer is an advocate for equity in education and has championed computer science education initiatives across the country for 2 decades.
Currently, I just became the CEO and founder of the Last Mile Education Fund, which is investing in the last mile for low-income women going after technology and engineering degrees. And we're filling in the gaps to help them get to graduation. But I've spent about 20 years working on gender equity and equity broadly in computer science and engineering fields and STEM, and working from K through 12 to now I'm working sort of at the 12 to 20 area, getting students out of the pipeline.
Temple and Farmer discuss their professional experience and the advice they would give to young people starting their careers. During her work with the National Center for Women, Farmer was invited to the White House to create the Champions of Change for Women and Girls in STEM.
And so I got an invitation with basically 4 days' notice to go to the White House for the event. And I immediately responded with, "Great, how many girls do you want me to bring?" And they said, "Well, that invitation was just for you." And I was like, "Well, it is women and girls in STEM. You want me to bring girls to this event, right?" So what I ultimately did was sent them a PDF with 8 girls, with their pictures, with details about what they were majoring in, where they went to college. So they let me bring all 8. And from then on, the White House was like, "Well, Ruth can show up with all these great young women that are doing computer science." And so it was very late at night, late 2015. I was talking to the contact there and I was like, "Hey, I was thinking about applying for this White House Fellows program. What do you think?" He's like, "You want a fellowship at the White House? Let's make one. When can you get here?" And so I got to spend a year in the White House, less than a year, but the last few months bringing as many stakeholders to the table as we could to make change, both inside the government and outside the government.
That's wonderful. It's also how just things can just sort of happen, almost kind of backdoor. And like a lot of jobs, good jobs, people get them just through connections, and you're in the right place at the right time.
I think I stress with young women that I talk to, there is nothing more important than your network. And I tell girls, I was like, "You need to network as if you're doing improv." And in the rules of improv, you always say yes and. You never say no, because no kills the story. And so what I tell students is, if you're at an event and somebody's like, "Boy, I really need a Java developer," your answer is, "I'm a Java developer. I've always wanted to learn Java. Maybe I could step up." Or, "I know this great other girl who's a Java developer." You either be the resource or you offer the resource, because then you're a resource.
Well, I've also learned you have to show off your work. And this is some of my drawings in my book, Thinking in Pictures. And a lot of people thought I was weird. I interrupt because I have trouble timing that. But I got into a lot of jobs by showing portfolios of my drawings and pictures of projects I had designed. Learned to sell my work rather than myself.
Both Temple and Farmer, in spite of their shared interest in drawing and drafting, were screened out of engineering degrees because of their experiences with math classes.
Yeah, I took drafting in high school. That was one of my favorite classes. And I actually, for a long time, I wanted to be an architect. And I did pretty poorly in math in high school because I'd moved a lot of times, and high school or math tends to be really linear in the instruction. And because I moved so much, I went to multiple elementary schools. I did manage one middle school. So my freshman year, they wanted to put me in remedial math, and I protested. I was like, I've been doing long division now for 4 years. I can't do anymore. And so I took algebra. It was like a completely different thing. I was like, oh, wow, I could do this. But I never saw myself as a math person. And I decided not to become an architect and went into communications instead, because I was afraid of the big math tests that architects have to take to qualify.
But you see, engineering school will screen someone like me out. I wanted to be a biomedical engineer. I am someone who has done quite a lot of engineering, and I cannot do higher math. But you need both kinds of thinkers. And I found in my work with large food processing plants, and I went back and I went through all the jobs where I spent a considerable amount of time building something big, you know, like a Cargill plant or some other plant. And the people I worked with are what I call the clever engineering department, usually high school degrees, and they got a label of draftsman. Let me tell you, that person's designing entire factories. They're not given enough credit. And then your more mathematical engineers will do boilers and refrigeration, roof snow loads, wind loads. But you need to have both.
I think broadly, though, I think we need all kinds of minds.
You do.
And our system has been set up to sort of filter people out. And what we really should be doing is welcoming people in. Because we're missing out on a lot of solutions by leaving out diverse minds of all kinds.
The other thing is that a lot of these kids are getting shunted into special ed, because I worked with people that own metal fabrication companies, have like 20 patents, make equipment that's sold around the world, and they're autistic, stutterers, dyslexic, about 20% of them. And now they don't get a chance to take shop. The worst thing the schools ever did was taking out all the hands-on classes. Worst thing they ever did. Because how can you find out you like welding, or you like fixing mechanical things, or you like music, or you like art or cooking or some other thing, if you don't ever do it? And I've never passed an algebra class. And so how did I manage to get through college? Well, in 67, algebra wasn't required. And what I did after I failed the first math quiz when I was an undergraduate taking finite math, which wasn't algebra, it was probability, matrices, and statistics. This was 1967. And I went to Mr. Dion's office. He tutored me like an hour, three times a week in his office. He was a brand new math teacher. And in a small college, you could have a similar situation in a community college. But I asked for help.
Well, and faculty want you to succeed. That's why they became faculty. Well, and I think letting young people know that, there's so much pressure on students to get perfect grades in order to get into a good college. And the bottom line is college is hard, especially if you're doing something in STEM. And you're not always going to have perfect grades. And that's okay. And you're going to struggle, and that's okay. And one of the things that I am fighting for with the Last Mile Education Fund is I think that low-income students deserve the freedom and luxury to struggle. But the way our system is set up right now, if you aren't perfect at every turn and on time at every turn as a low-income student, you'll run out the clock on your financial aid. You won't get the scholarships that are all based on GPA, and you're going to have trouble. And we're not investing in our young people the way we used to back when we founded the state university systems. So I've recently turned my focus to what happens to low-income students.
Okay.
And the experience of low-income students in our system. And I've realized, and this probably applies to your visual thinkers as well, that many of what we consider the markers of merit are actually markers of privilege and access. And, you know, if we're looking at a resume and saying, well, this student was the president of all the clubs on campus, and they went to hackathons every weekend, and they did side projects, well, they probably didn't have to work to pay for their rent. They probably had the time and the resources to do those things. And we're not equally valuing the ways that many low-income students are contributing to their family's income.
Well, that's right.
And their dollars are not all their own. And so what I really want to see happen is for the providers of education, as well as the employers, to really think critically about what unintentional barriers are set up into the system that make assumptions about people's access to things like credit and capital. And as an example of this, last summer, I got an email through a colleague from a young Latina in Texas who had been accepted to an AI program at Stanford, and it cost $800. And she was asking for $800 to attend this AI program. So I made a call and I was like, can you find out for me who runs this program? And once I found out, I was like, look, we have a Latina who wants to learn AI. This $800 should not be a barrier. Can you find, you know? And they're like, oh yeah, we were planning to have a scholarship, but we didn't set it up yet. I'm like, no, no, no. When you set up a program, you need to say upfront, scholarships are available. We have accommodations for students with disabilities. People should not have to ask those questions. Those should be front and center that they are available. And so this girl, she did the AI program and she wrote us the most wonderful thank you note. She's super, super excited. She went back to her high school in Texas.
In addition to the importance of formal educational opportunities, Temple and Farmer discuss how critical it is for students to practice hands-on skills and build resilience.
We got a lot of students growing up today that don't do any of these things. They don't go outside. When I did a book signing for Calling All Minds, I found out that 20 or 30% of the kids, this actually was an affluent area, had elementary school children had never made a paper airplane in their life.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was 3 years ago. That's recent. Also, wow. You've got kids. I had a teacher, in all seriousness, one of the projects in there, it's just a simple paper snowflake. And I had a teacher ask me in all seriousness, this was this year, what would happen to kids' self-esteem if they made a paper snowflake and when they unfolded it fell apart? Wouldn't that hurt?
They'd make another one.
You make another one. But a teacher asked me that in absolute seriousness. That's within the last year. This is recent.
See, I think we have to normalize trying and we have to normalize failing. Because that's part of the design process. You try something and it doesn't work, and you try another thing. And so one of the things that I would really like to see is we have this history in our society of like winner takes all, you know, the science fair, who's the best of the best. But what about all the triers? Like, what are we doing to invest in the triers? Because the winners are going to be fine. But the triers might just need to try something different or to try something again or to have access. And so I'm really pushing towards this abundance viewpoint of who has talent, an abundance viewpoint of who has potential, and finding ways to incubate what is sadly would be considered the B team, but they're really just the team that needs a little more practice or a little more access.
One of the things that I think is we got to get the shop classes back into the schools because we're not forming the little bitty shops anymore.
Making is coming back, you know, now there's a lot of 3D printing and making and it's really shop class by another name.
But there's some schools that have none of this.
Most schools have none of this.
All around the country. Some schools are bringing this stuff back. I think Texas is one of the states getting some of this stuff back and they get somebody that graduates in the program and they're hired instantly. I went to a maker fair, it was probably about 5 years ago now, that was in Boulder, and they had a lot of electronic stuff there, and it was mainly for, you know, elementary kids, maybe middle school. And you know what the big hit was? Washing machine boxes. They had a great time cutting the cardboard, and you can cut that big, that heavy cardboard with a hacksaw blade that's taped on one end.
Well, I think, too, that... you know, kids have imaginations and so many of our toys and devices take away that imagination part of it. and replace that with something that's told to you. And, you know, I think, you know, give a kid a box of recycling and he can make all kinds of toys out of that. And I think that the play and the tinkering, all of that is really, really important.
I think it's super important, but we got kids growing up today that have never used a tool. I was using hammer, screwdriver, and pliers at about second grade. And I figured out a way to make a parachute that I made out of a scarf open better by putting two coat hanger crossbars. And that is in my book, Calling All Minds. And I can remember my little kid hands were not strong enough to cut a coat hanger wire, but I could dent it. But there's other places where I've got students in my livestock class, they have to do a scale drawing. I have students ask me, why would drawing a scale drawing be important? And I said, well, if you're going to remodel your house, it might be important. If you buy a couch, maybe you better measure it to make sure it fits in the elevator. And I had a student in my class last semester who had never used a ruler to measure anything. And I am getting concerned that we're getting students that are going to go into policy and all kinds of stuff growing up totally removed from the world of the practical. How do we actually get stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll make policy about stuff that they don't know anything about. And there's not enough respect for know-how.
So are you proposing, a return to apprenticeships? And
we need to be doing some apprenticeships. And it also gives the students a chance to try on stuff.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, apprenticeships in the United States have seen 70% growth since 2011, with more than 349,000 apprentices completing one in the past 5 years. Those who graduate from an apprenticeship have a 92% employment retention and earn, on average, $300,000 more than their peers who do not. Beyond these opportunities, developing educational initiatives is a key part of farmers' work. Once these projects have been tested and proven, they're shared with the people, organizations, and communities that could be invested in them, a process that both Ruth and Temple have personal experience with.
And I found in developing the design and discovery curriculum with Intel that the most powerful thing about that program was that we didn't tell the students what engineering problems they needed to solve. We let them pick. Good. We said, make a list of everything that bugs you. What bugs you? And they'd make this big list of things that bug them. And by the end of the program, they had to stand up in front of a group and present the problem they were solving, their prototype, and their 6-month plan of how they were going to get there.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's wonderful.
It was one of the most fantastic programs I've ever seen. And the types of the way that these girls were so engaged in solving this. And one of the projects I remember that I really loved was a young woman who her parents were not in her life. So she's living with her grandparents, and it was Oregon where it rains all the time.
Yeah.
And her tennis shoes would get wet. And she would put her tennis shoes in the dryer and they would clomp, 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 clomp and make noise. And it would irritate her grandfather. So she ended up coming up with a mesh bag that had super powerful magnets on it that would magnet to the inside of the dryer. So as the dryer tumbled, the shoes didn't hit the sides.
Oh, that's so clever.
It's so clever. And I was like, oh my gosh, you could sell this. You could sell this. And
it's so clever. You see, what I've learned about thinking is that the visual thinker and the math thinker were both bottom-up thinkers. Plan up all projects. There's a tendency for the verbal thinkers. Oh, big, high ideas about inclusion, but how do you actually do it? See, my approach would be to write up about programs that actually worked. You know, specific
That's actually a big approach at both in the White House and at CS for All. One of the things we did was what we called commitments. And one of my favorites in all the many years of doing commitments was a program out of a land-grant university in West Virginia. It was called Project Code Nodes. And they had a coding club program for girls of color. And they were hosting it at the university, but obviously, you know, not every kid can get to the university. So they formed a partnership with PAC, the Partnership of African American Churches, okay. And they started holding those coding clubs in the churches.
Good.
The kids already go where their parents are comfortable, where they have a relationship.
I found out.
And that's kind of what the commitments are about, is like, we call it scout and scale. So let's find things that are great and talk about them and write about them and show everyone else how to copy them.
Okay.
Because that's about how getting the word out. And
let's just look at the church thing. Okay. That's a resource a lot of people have. So one of the things I would do if I was pushing this program is I want to write some articles in some church publications. Getting, you know, that's getting right down on, you know, right where the people are. But you see, if you get this into church magazines or church blogs and websites, then that's one avenue where you can get these programs to grow and explain how to do it in a not abstract way. And then there might be something else that you just do through the local high school. There might be a different thing you did, or you do it for Girl Scouts, or you do something through FFA. But then you got to write something in the FFA teacher publications, websites and blogs and things like that. So you'd write one set of stuff for church publications, another set of stuff for FFA ag teacher publications, another thing for Girl Scouts. You see, each one of these is like a separate entity on how you can start these programs.
Well, and lots of these sort of what I call like plug and play or shovel ready things have been created that are really great and propagating around the country. There's a really cool program that pops up computer training at laundromats.
Okay.
Because families spend 2-3 hours doing their laundry. Well, and there's a laundromat association, actually, that a few years ago, they announced a program, which I love, called Wash Time is Talk Time, which was kiosks set up in laundromats all over the nation to educate parents and encourage them to spend the time doing their laundry, talking and reading to their kids, because low-income students are spoken to 30,000 words less by the time they're age 3 than affluent kids. So helping close that early childhood education gap. But like, that's the way I think, is I think about like, what are the big systems that already exist that we can leverage? And how do we take something like the Girl Scouts or the churches or our existing infrastructure? Where are the places girls and boys go? There's a really great program in Memphis that they put shipping containers in the parks and set up computer labs in the shipping container in the parks to do the kids' homework and help them, because the kids can't necessarily come to them, but the kids are going to the park to play basketball or do whatever they're doing. So there's a lot of really innovative approaches out there, people are smart. And
each one of these approaches is specific.
Well, and I think that one thing that we haven't done well as a society is communicate to young people how much creativity and actually do-gooding is in the world of engineering and STEM. That, you know, we talk about, if you want to help people, you have to be a nurse, or you want to help people, you have to be a human rights lawyer. But the amount of impact you can have as an engineer is exponential.
The work the Farmer does goes beyond individual programs. Women make up more than half of the nation's college-educated workforce, but only 28% of the STEM workforce. Even worse, from 2017 to 2018, only 14% of those earning bachelor's degrees in STEM were women of color.
I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, systems change, in that a lot of what I've spent my time doing over the last 2 decades is thinking beyond the outputs, which is like the students and the teachers are the outputs, and people want to like, I'm going to do a program for kids, or I'm going to do a training for teachers. But what I think we really need to do to get to like permanent change is we need to think about the system that produces And how is that system leaving people out or disenfranchising people? How is it not working equitably for everyone?
I went to a fancy place probably 5 years ago. I won't say where it was. The degree engineers got offices in the tower. My department got stuck in a service tunnel with cable trays in the ceiling. Every time I look up at a cable tray now, I think of this. One thing I can say about the meat industry, we're Democratic. Everybody in the engineering department, the draftsman and the degree engineer has a horrible office. We're Democratic.
You know what? My sister is a chemical engineer and she builds oil refineries and processing plants. And she told me about having a job as a consultant on the really big Exxon, I think it was Exxon plant in Texas, and shows up to this just awful trailer. Just this awful trailer, and very, very, very few women on the site, and that people would come in and out of the trailer, and they would walk right past three men's desks and come up to her and say, "Can you make some copies?" And she's like, "I bill at $280 an hour. Do you want me to make copies?" And that there was this real gender imbalance in her space. Now, I know you experienced a lot of that in your industry. How have you seen that change?
Well, things are a lot better. When I started out in the 70s, there were absolutely no women working cattle out in the feed yards and things like that. That's really changed. Now, I had a lot of gender discrimination, and most all of my problems were not with the owner of the plant or the owner of the feed yard or the big managers. It was the foremans, the intermediate level managers. That's where 90% of my trouble was. They didn't like this girl nerd coming in on their turf. That's where the problems were. Another thing is I had to be like three times better than a guy. And as I went in the industry, I was appalled at mistakes guys could make and still have jobs.
There's a blog I read a few years ago that I really love called "I Can't Wait to Meet a Bad Woman Engineer." And it talks about the fact that, like, how come every time you hear about a woman engineer, she's some kind of super person who, you know, is an amazing engineer, plus has three kids, plus runs her like Girl Scout troop and everything. It's because anyone who wasn't that 150% person is off in a different field now because we've driven them out. That women have to be so much more than their male peers to be treated with a similar level of respect, or they even still don't get that in terms of pay. I do know, I'm excited that Colorado just passed a gender pay transparency law that went into effect recently. And hopefully we'll start to see some impact of that. Well, I really appreciate talking to you. And I would say again that I have admired your work for a long time. I watched the movie about you. I think it was 2009 when I watched it. And it's such an honor to be here to talk to you. And there's so many different ways that we're going to get this job done.
That's right.
For young people. And we need as many minds and hands at the door as we can.
That's right. That's just so important. I'm going to sign off now. And it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was scientist Temple Grandin and Ruth Farmer, founder of the Last Mile Education Fund. I'm Jalene Bailey.
How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Media. It is made possible by funding from the National Science Foundation's Advanced Technological Education Program.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.